to the chief musician, Altisheth, Mictam of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave. Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge, until these calamities be overpast. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up. Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves. Selah. My heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. Awake up, my glory. Awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people, and I will sing unto thee among the nations. For thy mercy is great unto the heavens, and thy truth unto the clouds. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now, this Lord's Day morning, as we come to Psalm 57, we see again that this psalm is a prayer of affliction. And I've titled this psalm, Destroy Not. From the very title itself, this Hebrew word, Altasheth. And we'll look at that in just a moment. But the next three psalms, or next two psalms, 58 and 59, as well as 75, have this word in the title. Some believe it's borrowed from the prayer of Moses in Deuteronomy 9:26, where he asks the Lord not to destroy the people of Israel. There's some question about what it refers to, but I think it's most likely referring to David telling his men not to destroy or to kill Saul. Now, the occasion is, it says, when he is in the cave. Quite literally in the Hebrew, it could be in caves, plural. So, as I said, it's similar to Psalm 56. but it's likely during a period of wandering and danger and distress that David was in while he spent that period having to run from Saul. The outline is he begins with prayer, complaint, and assurance in verses 1 through 5, and then he concludes with joy and praise in verses 6 through 11. Now, my outline is going to follow Matthew Henry significantly, but slightly altered. There's a lot of question when you're interpreting Psalms. Should you use the Selahs as potentially a sign of the break in thought, or the chorus, or both? And I tend to think we probably should use the chorus as overriding, even above the Selahs or the rest. And so there clearly is a chorus here, verse 5 and verse 11, and so I've divided the psalm in that light. In the title, we have to the chief musician. In other words, this song, this prayer is for safekeeping and for congregational singing. As I said, its title is Altasheth. Destroy not. It's a miktam or a mystery. Some people think this refers to gold. So it's a golden psalm. It's a special psalm. It's a psalm of David. As I said, it's when he fled from Saul in the caves. And so we have a reference in 1 Samuel 24, 9, when he was in the cave and Saul comes in and David tells his men, don't touch him. Don't hurt him. Don't harm him. And so many believe this is related to that, maybe that very event, or at least several of the events where he finds Saul, or Saul, he's in a cave and Saul comes in the cave. Now, verses 1 and 5, I said David begins with prayer, complaint, and assurance. First, he supports himself with faith and hope in God in verses 1 through 3. In verse 1, all his dependence is upon God. Be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpassed. So David's asking God to be merciful to him. He says it twice. He's emphatic. Remember the publican children in Luke 18:13. Goes to the temple and asks for mercy. Be merciful unto me, the sinner. He goes to God's wings. Here's the metaphor of chicks coming under their mother hen's wings for protection so that the hawks don't come down, swoop down and pick them up. And so that's the picture there. Speaks of calamities. Calvin thinks that word calamity could be translated wickedness. Not so much not as though David was wicked, but the calamities that were upon him were due to the wickedness of someone else, Saul himself. But Spurgeon says, our calamities are a matter of time, but our safety is a matter of eternity. You see, I will make my refuge until these calamities be overpassed. The psalmist believes that these calamities will come to an end. They're in time. And by faith believes they will not continue. So he shows his dependence upon God in verse 1. In verse 2, we see his desire towards God. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. So we see he's trusting God and fleeing to God, desiring God. For two reasons he cries. Because God is Most High. He's omniscient, he's all-powerful, omnipotent, but also that he performs these things for David. In other words, he's thinking about his previous experiences of deliverance, and those encourage him to continue to cry in the present. Clearly, David, like Paul, recognized that all things were working together for his good, since he was called according to God's purpose. But then in verse 3, we see his expectation is from God. He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up. Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and truth. He shall. There David's exercising faith. He shall send from heaven. The fountain of all the blessings that will come upon David will be from heaven. Some commentators think this refers to angels. It certainly does, but I don't think it just refers to angels. I think it's talking ultimately of all the ways that God orders things for the good of his people. But certainly sending of his angels to defend his people is one of the ways that God does protect us and deliver us, to save him, to deliver him from the reproach of him that would swallow him up. In other words, these dogs bite and bark. They desire to swallow him up, but they will also reproach him. And literally, this verse, this phrase could mean the devourer that has reviled. In other words, the one that wants to devour me is at present reviling me. He cannot at present devour me. That's his end. He is engaged in slandering David at this point. Clearly, Saul wants those in his crowd to assist him in bringing down David. Well, how does he do that? He has to speak ill of David to convince those in his entourage them hunting David is warranted. And so that's what clearly David is praying against. In verse 4, David represents the power and malice of his enemies. My soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men, whose teeth are spears and swords, and their tongue a sharp sword. So here we see again these enemies of David. He's among lions. He's like Daniel in the lion's den. He's got ferocious enemies, and guess what? They're in the cave that David's in. Some commentators think when he speaks of than being set on fire. He may be referring to a fire or two that they may have lit in the cave that now illuminated the cave that David was hiding somewhere in the dark recesses of. It's also possible that this word refers to them being enraged. So it could be lions that are ready to devour. They're enraged. And again, they use their teeth and their tongue. They desire to destroy, but they will slander as well. Think of Psalm 42:10, where we read, "As with a sword in my bones, mine enemies reproach me." As I've told you before, children, that little ditty, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me," is not accurate. It's not biblical. Because routinely in the Scriptures, particularly in the Psalms and Proverbs, we find that words do hurt. We shouldn't be surprised that they hurt. And if we think they don't, we're really trying to behave very stoical, and that's not being biblical. Certainly men of God in the past and women of God did hurt, like a sword breaking their bones. Can you imagine how much that would hurt? And have a big steel sword come by and break your bones as it goes through you. He says sometimes these words hurt like that, David says in Psalm 42. So he represents the power and the malice of his enemies. Then in verse 5, in the chorus, he prays to God to glorify himself and his own great name. "Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth." You might have thought that David was going to ask for his name to be exalted. His name's being dragged through the mud. And obviously, in a sense, there's other parts of Scripture where suggest that that's okay to ask for your own name to be exalted. But David had it right. He had the principle of the Lord's Prayer in mind. What's the first great petition? "Hallowed be thy name." He was seeking first the kingdom of God. And in all this, he wanted God ultimately to be glorified. And he suggests that he desires him to be glorified above his works. As great as God's works are, and as much glory as we can give to God for what he has made, are we not to glorify him for who he is in himself? And so that's his focus here in verse 5. We'll see that as well in the second chorus in verse 11. So David begins with prayer, complaint, and assurance. Then he concludes with joy and praise in verses 6 and 11. Spurgeon says, as we move to this section, "The poet is in the shadows of the cave at first, but he comes to the cavern's mouth at last and sings in the sweet fresh air with his eye on the heavens, watching joyously the clouds floating therein." So do you get the picture, children? In the first part of this psalm, he's in the dark part of the cave while Saul and his men are in the front part of the cave potentially lighting fires and continuing to think about how they're going to find David, trying to figure out where he's at. But then in the second part, it sounds like he's coming out spiritually. And now he's seeing the bright of day. He's complaining about the situation he's under. He's telling God, speaking real honestly to God about the struggles he's having of soul. And then through that, he exercises his faith and believes. And then he can rejoice even before he's been delivered from Saul. This is all before the final deliverance from Saul. There's no evidence that Saul's dead, and now David's been installed at this point when he writes this portion of the psalm. And yet he can joy. Let's see how. First, he reminds himself for the reason of praise. He comes back to speak of his enemies in verse 6. "They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they shall fall," or "they are fallen themselves." Selah. "They are fallen" is past tense. So this is a prophetic thing. David believes in faith. This is going to happen. And so it's as good as done for David. He's pressed down. likely suggests that he's caught in a trap. And he says his soul is bowed down. So they prepared a net. His soul is bowed down. Potentially, the picture is he's already kind of somewhat caught in the net. Not yet. The person that set the trap not necessarily have come yet and taken the animal and killed the animal, but he's caught up and he's bowed down. They've dug a pit before me. In other words, they've set me up. They know the direction I'm heading, and they've put the pit in the direction I'm heading. Isn't that what Daniel's enemies did to him in Babylon? They knew he wasn't going to give up being faithful in his prayer times. So what do? Well, we set something up so we can catch him there. Let's make that illegal. Then the king will have to deal with it. And so David says, they're coming at me in the ways that they think I'm going to go. But he, by faith, believes that destruction will come upon them. It's very interesting in the history of 1 Samuel, we find when Saul was pursuing David in the caves, the Philistines invaded him in Israel, and he had to go fight that battle, and David was freed. And so that's the way that God was pleased at that time to deliver David. Then we have a Selah there at the end of verse 6. Spurgeon says, "We may sit down at the pit's mouth and view with wonder the just retaliations of providence." And here he's saying, take a pause as he thinks about his enemies and as he would have us, since he's given this to the chief musician, for us to sing, to consider the enemies of God's people. Then in verse 7, he prepares himself for the duty of praise. "My heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise." He declares twice that his heart is fixed or erect or lifted up or prepared. It's probably contrast to verse 6 where he says, "My soul is bowed down." Providences are such that his soul is bowed down, and yet he's resolving himself to be fixed and steadfast. He's not going to allow this discouragement to get the best of him and to take him off of his meeting with the Lord. Too often we make excuses in our preparation to meet with God because we're distressed, we're disturbed, there's an upheaval. And David says, "I'm not going to allow that to bother me. I'm prepared. I'm resolved." I think first he's saying against providence, what God might bring in providence. Think of Paul's words in Acts 20, 24, where he tells those that are with him that he knows what awaits him in Jerusalem, but he says, "None of these things move me. I know what's coming, and it's not going to be delightful." He's not a masochist. He's not looking forward to it. But he says, "None of these things will move me nonetheless. I will be steadfast." I think that's the picture we have here at David. But in 7b, I think he's probably referring to his continuing to worship. "I will sing and praise," obviously. He's resolved to continue to attend upon the Lord without distraction in the midst of this trial. And then we find in verse 8 how he excites himself to praise. "Awake up, my glory, awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early." Awake up, my glory. He's stirring himself up for worship. He's saying, "Get up, sluggard." He's telling himself, I'm slothful, I'm sluggardly. Awake. Awake my glory. Psalm 16 apparently refers to the tongue when it speaks of our glory. But there are other portions of Scripture that refer to one's soul as their glory. Clearly we sing with our tongue, but out of the heart the mouth speaketh. So I think we could see it kind of referring to both. Our heart and our heart's perspectives giving vent through our speech, through our praying, through our praising. Awake up, my glory, awake, psaltery in heart. And now he's talking about accompaniment that he will use in singing and glorifying God in his deliverance. And then he says, I myself will awake early. Literally, we can read that phrase, I will awake early daily. And again, it's something like Psalm 5. He's committing himself to routinely meeting with the Lord morning by morning. Matthew Henry says, when God is coming towards us with His favors, we must go forth to meet Him with our praises. Having prepared himself for praise in verse 7, having excited himself to praise in verse 8, he then pleases himself with the work of praise in verse 9. I will praise Thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto Thee among the nations. With an enlarged heart, David is prepared and he desires to see other people come under the gospel message or to hear his praise. In other words, his worship is moving to witness. Calvin says these words have reference to Christ and the New Testament church. Romans 15:9 quotes Psalm 18:49, which is somewhat parallel to this verse. And there, Paul speaking says that the Gentiles might glorify God for His mercy. In other words, his desire is that the gospel might go forth so that the Gentiles might glorify God for His mercy, as it is written. And then he quotes Psalm 18:49, for this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles and sing unto thy name. So it's a messianic prophecy that Jesus will confess the Father among the Gentiles and sing unto his name. Matthew Henry, commenting on this verse, says, David in his Psalms, which fill the universal church, and will to the end of time, may be said to still be praising God among the people and singing to Him among the nations. For all good people make use of His words in praising God. He says David's words are going to be used throughout the ages in praising God. And that's the picture there. He desires his praise to go forth and the Gentiles to hear it. Then in verse 10, we find David furnishing himself with matter for praise. For thy mercy is great unto the heavens, and thy truth unto the clouds. You notice that mercy is central in this psalm. It's central in many of the psalms. God's mercy is a summary of all His favor towards us. If God's merciful to us, He's going to be favorable to us in so many ways. And so that's been what David's been asking in verse 1. Be merciful unto me. Now he's praising God for the fact that God is merciful and will be merciful to him, because His mercy is great under the heavens. It's a hyperbole. It's a picture of God's infinite mercy, that His loving kindness is new every morning. He's never running out of His mercy or His loving kindness because it's infinite. And thy truth unto the clouds. I think what we should understand by truth here particularly is God's promises. God is true to the promises that He's made, promises for good for His people. David knows that God has promised to be merciful to him and to his people in general, and so he expects him to be. So he's exercising his faith. And when you exercise something, children, what happens? If you exercise a muscle, it gets bigger. And that's one of the blessings, one of the reasons, not the reason, but one of the reasons that God gives us trials. And so we'll exercise our faith, so we'll grow stronger. It's all for our good, but one of it is through the exercise of our faith. Our faith is strengthened. And then in verse 11, he prays to God to glorify himself and his own great name again. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. One of the commentators said, the sum of his prayer is the sum of his praises. In other words, the first four verses are his prayer, which is somewhat of a complaint. And yet the sum or conclusion of it is verse 5. Then in the second section, verse 6 through 10, he moves to praising God, and he concludes with the same words. So the sum of his prayer and the sum of his praise is all to the glory of God. It's all about glorifying God. Whether we're asking God for things or whether we're praising Him for who He is and what He has done, we're still ultimately to do it for His glory, not ours. Matthew Henry says in the praises, speaking of this verse, he says, in the praises of the church triumphant, God is exalted to the heavens. And in the praises of the church militant, that's the church on earth, the fighting church, thy glory is throughout all the earth. But thou art above all the blessing and praise of both. And therefore, Lord, exalt thyself above the heavens and above all the earth. Father, glorify thy own name. Thou hast glorified it. Glorify it again. In other words, he's saying, and he thinks this is what the psalmist is saying, God's people are glorifying God through the earth. God's people that have gone to be with Him, as well as the angelic host, are glorifying Him in heaven. And yet His glory far exceeds all of our efforts to glorify Him. We don't add to His glory by all our praise of Him. He is inherently, eternally glorious. And so in application, just consider Matthew Henry's words. He says, we may take direction and encouragement both in our supplications and in our thanksgivings and may offer both to God in singing this psalm. This is a psalm of prayer and of praise. John Brown encourages us, while I sing, let my cry aloud for mercy, cry aloud for mercy. Let me lay up spiritual and temporal adversities before the Lord, and let me triumph in the God of my salvation and employ Him to glorify His name in all the earth. Let's close in prayer.